Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 152, recorded Monday, May 19th, 2014. Our final invention. Triangulation is brought to you by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll finally have your entire financial life in one place and get a clear view of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/triangulation. And by Prosper. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace that connects people who are looking to borrow money with those who have money to lend. Visit prosper.com/twit and receive a $50 Amazon gift card when you get a loan. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get some of the most interesting, provocative, fascinating people in technology together and spend some time talking to them with your help in the chat room. James Barrett is our guest. I first heard of James on This Week in Law. Denise Howell had him on talking about his new book, Our Final Invention, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era. Holy cow. James Barrett is a documentarian, a filmmaker, and has written a very provocative book. James, thanks for joining us on Triangulation.
Thanks for having me, Leo. It's good to be here.
So as a documentarian, this is kind of, how did you get involved in the idea of artificial intelligence?
Well, I'd been interested in AI for a long time, and then about 12 years ago now, I made a film about artificial intelligence, and I got to interview some really influential people. I interviewed Ray Kurzweil, who, as you know, with his singularity concept and his books, is very optimistic about a time when we share the planet with smarter than human machines. And I interviewed Rodney Brooks, the founder of iRobot, who was also very optimistic. And then I interviewed Arthur C. Clarke, the science fiction writer. And until I spoke with him, I'd been very optimistic about the day that we share the planet with smarter than human machines. And he said, oh, no, not so much. It's intelligence will win out in whatever form it's in. And that planted a seed in my mind. He actually said something like this. He said, we control the future not because we're the fastest creature or the strongest creature, but because we're the most intelligent. And when we share the planet with something more intelligent than we are, that thing will steer the future. And so that planted a big seed of doubt in my mind, and I started talking to AI makers, AI professionals.
Are you going to make a movie out of this?
I'm developing a film about this, and now I'm trying to decide whether to make it an independent feature or to take it to one of the networks. But yes, it's in development now.
We've interviewed, Ray on this show. We've interviewed many, people who have dealt in the field of artificial intelligence. And, most recently we talked to, now it's escaping me, he wrote on Intelligence, founder of Palm, and his company, Numenta, is actually working towards a human-style artificial intelligence. Jeff Hawkins. In every case, when I talk to the scientists who are involved in AI, they're sanguine about the future of AI. Hawkins said the only negative thing I've heard, which is, well, just don't let it replicate, which you kind of echo, and you also point out how difficult that might be. But almost everybody else says, no, you don't have to. Kurzweil very famously told me, no, we're their creators. They're going to love us as we love our parents. They're not going to harm us. You're not a computer scientist. This is artificial intelligence is a technical field.
That's right.
Why do you think that the scientists who are involved in this don't fear it?
Well, the scientists, we've spoken to different scientists. Stuart Russell just came out. Stuart Russell co-wrote the book, the standard textbook on AI, Artificial Intelligence, A Modern Approach. He just came out with Max Tegmark, a physicist, and Stephen Hawking, in a Huffington Post article about 2 weeks ago that said, let's be very concerned about the development of superintelligence, of smarter than human intelligence. I interviewed a lot of AI professionals for my book, and actually the people who are concerned about the unrestricted, uncontrolled development of AI, those people are mostly the people quoted in this book are mostly programmers and people that work in AI.
All right.
So
I'm
so
talking
Stuart
to the wrong
Russell,
people.
Peter Norvig is the other author of A Modern Approach, and in that book, in the foreword, they say we have to take the development of superintelligence as seriously as the development of nuclear fission. So, you know, those are the most elite programmers that
All
I
right.
know of.
You're right. And Norvig's brilliant. And, of course, he's at Google right now.
Yes.
Which many people think is, in fact, the Skynet that they talk about in the Terminator, the beginning of an intelligent network. You actually talk – well, I think for one of the reasons that some of the scientists I talk to are less worried is that that for a long time it's felt that AI has failed, that we, in fact, tried to make machines as smart as humans – and we have failed at that. Do you think that point of view is changing?
Oh, yes. I think that, you know, we've had a series of AI springs way back since, I guess in the late 50s when Marvin Minsky coined the term artificial intelligence and they had the Dartmouth Conference. There's been a lot of AI springs, but until recently we haven't had the computer capability to begin to model the kind of cognition that will be required for anything like human-level intelligence. But now that hardware is in place, and we've seen the consistent advance of Moore's Law, and also what Ray Kurzweil calls the law of accelerating returns, we see the hardware and the technology and the software coming online, and we see consistent improvements. So I think the AI winter is over, and right now we're in an AI spring. This is the century of AI. Just the way that electricity powered the 20th century and steam powered the 19th century, I think artificial intelligence will fuel the 21st century.
It was the science fiction author Werner Vinge who coined the term technological singularity. And of course, Ray Kurzweil has taken it and run with it. Kurzweil, it's partly intelligence, but it's nanotech, it's other technologies all converging at once. And his point, which it's hard to deny, is that this is all accelerating at such a rate now, such an exponential rate, that he says in the next few decades, we will finally create machines indistinguishable from human beings. Do you agree with that?
I think that he's absolutely right. He talks about nano, info, bio, and cogno, as you said, and the confluence that he predicts will happen around 2045 when everything reaches fruition. But he says by 2029 we'll create machines or computers with all the nuance of logical and emotional intelligence that we have. So he says 2029. The people I polled say anywhere from 2020 to 2100, and then a very small percent of AI professionals say never. But yes, I think we're on the cusp of creating smarter than human level intelligence, and then shortly after that, smarter than human intelligence. And that's why people are coming out now and saying, well, maybe we should set some bylaws, maybe we should set some standards for the development of AI. What was really a really hopeful sign recently was when the DoD came out just a couple of days ago, and they've given $7 million to five universities to look into the question of autonomous machines. Autonomous, and what they're talking about is autonomous drones, autonomous battlefield robots. And these are not friendly AI machines, but very unfriendly AI machines. But they want to create machines that are imbued with ethics. And so it's extremely encouraging to see the deepest pockets, the DoD, get behind the pursuit of ethical advanced artificial intelligence. Because when you talk about autonomous drones and autonomous battlefield robots that act and that kill without humans in the loop, you're talking about very advanced AI. So that was a very good sign.
So you make
it's also a sign. Yeah, it's also a sign that they take it very seriously. That this question is coming at us very fast.
Of course, the DOD researches a lot of crazy things, including making goats sleep with their minds. But nevertheless, I think that they're fairly serious about AI.
It's a pretty good movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, they are.
You talk about different kinds of AI. It's not AI, but ASI that you're worried about. What is that?
Well, just to give viewers a little bit of grounding in all these crazy acronyms, AI is artificial intelligence, and that's humankind, intelligence of human type in a machine. Now, we use AI all the time. We use it for search, for navigation, for theorem proving, for a lot of things. And right now, it does a lot of things better than we do. AGI, the next acronym, is artificial general intelligence. And that's human-level intelligence in a machine, and that's down the road. Beyond that is ASI, or artificial superintelligence, and that's smarter than human intelligence. And that's the one we need to really watch out for.
Does one naturally lead to the other?
Well, once you achieve, according to Werner Wingen, according to I.J. Goode, I.J. Goode was a mathematician who in the 1960s proposed an idea called the intelligence explosion. And he said, basically, when you create machines with all the capabilities of human intelligence, then shortly after that, that will create machines that are slightly smarter. Then the machines themselves will set the rate of progress. You know, we've created, and to paraphrase him, we've created machines now that do a lot of things, that play Jeopardy, play chess, do a lot of the things I talked about, search, navigation, theorem proving. They do those things as well or better than humans. In the not too distant future, we'll create machines that do artificial intelligence research and development better than humans. At that point, the machines themselves will set the pace of advancement, and we'll no longer be setting that. So that concept is called the intelligence explosion. And yes, I think AGI, or human level intelligence, necessarily leads to smarter than human intelligence.
I think maybe where there might be a disconnect is that does AI lead to AGI? In other words, I've had this argument with Ray Kurzweil. Of course, I'm a patser compared to Kurzweil, and I really shouldn't be arguing anything with him. But it does seem to me that we've stumbled quite a bit with AI and have yet to make anything. You mentioned Watson and Deep Blue, but these are not very good examples of intelligence, let alone AGI.
Well, you have to kind of look where we've been and where we're going. Here's a sort of a litmus test of how good AI has become. Look at the jobs it's displacing. Look at the jobs displaced by automation and by AI. Right now, sports writers, sports writers, postal workers of all kinds, sports writers are going out because there's a bunch of companies that are creating machines that write narrative stories. There'll be a lot of jobs displaced by AI as we go down the road. If they're replacing jobs, Watson right now, IBM's Watson, the one at Jeopardy, is studying to take the federal medical licensing exam so it can become a physician's assistant. It's learning vast amounts of legal texts so that it can become essentially a lawyer or a legal researcher. We know, we can see how automation and AI are replacing jobs right now. So to people who say AI is not doing very well, I say, look at the jobs it's replacing. It's replacing human jobs.
Yeah, but I don't think anybody would.
MIT. MIT said, just came out with a report that said within 20 years, 50% of all jobs will be replaced by automation and AI. So, if that's not doing well, I don't know what standard it has to reach for people to concede that it is doing very well.
Well, machines have replaced humans and human jobs going back to mechanical looms. That's not intelligence.
True.
That's automation. There's quite a leap between. I don't think anyone would mistake these machine-generated prose with human-generated prose.
Oh yes, they do all the time.
Really?
You read it every day, and you don't. In my book, I've got an example of two two games, two basketball games that were, one was reported by a human, the other was reported by AI. I think AI has a slight lead on that. there's a company called Narrative Science that's putting out not just sports articles, but editorials, and pretty soon just regular news reporting. And they're doing, there are thousands of articles that you read every day that are generated by computers. And the, here's another litmus test. You don't even know it.
If you're saying that, yeah. I don't.
No, it's look up Narrative Science. Look at the stuff they do. Look up Statsheet. Statsheet is the trade name for a company in North Carolina that's putting out thousands of sports articles. So, you know, we've got there's job displacement going on right now with automation, but intelligence is also displacing jobs.
You actually indict my profession for not taking this more seriously. You think tech journalists are not paying too much attention to this. And I have to admit, I'm a little skeptical because I've yet to see a machine. Of course, then it's going to be too late when I do. But I've yet to see a machine that shows any signs of actual human intelligence. I mean, these are mechanistic. I mean, writing a sports article
right.
is not intelligence necessarily. It's mechanical.
Here's the other thing. Here's another interesting thing that happens with AI. Every time something is accomplished by AI, pundits say, well, that's not really AI.
Right.
You know, AI just beat the two world champions in Jeopardy at Jeopardy. That's a very nuanced game. That requires a very deep knowledge of language, of a huge body of not really common sense knowledge, but kind of an ontology or a database of knowledge. It requires word use. It requires knowledge of puns and understanding puns and jokes. It's a complicated game, and that's pretty intelligent. Now, what I suggest is look at where Watson is now, and then think of Watson in 10 years. What's Watson going to be doing? I'd say Watson will be ready for the Turing test. And you know the Turing test. It was called the imitation game by computer legend Alan Turing. And basically, it says that if a judge is communicating by teletype with two people or two things, and it can't tell which one is human and which one is the robot, then that robot, that AI has passed the Turing test. And that's a fairly well-accepted test for computer or machine intelligence. I think that's 10 years from now. I don't think that's going to be out of Watson's capability, maybe even sooner than 10 years. So, you know, we're not seeing anything that mirrors human intelligence right now. We're not seeing cognitive architectures with anything like general human intelligence. But we can see the trajectory. We can see that jobs are being displaced. We can see that big debates are happening right now about making machines autonomous. So these questions aren't a waste of our time. They're happening, and they're going to happen sooner than we think.
No, I agree with you. And even if this leap from mechanical intelligence to actual human intelligence is a difficult and maybe impossible leap, it's certainly prudent to think about it in case it does happen. So I'm not against thinking about the future. Isaac Asimov thought about this, and you talk about this in the book with his Rules for Robotics. That was his way of saying, well, we've got to somehow protect ourselves against these robots. You kind of dismiss this as a fictional device and not something very useful.
You know, Isaac Asimov was not trying to make rules for robots. He was trying to generate fiction. The three laws of robotics, and ultimately four laws, were made to create tension, create stories. If you read the book that the laws came from, called iRobot, every one of those stories is a failure
right.
of the three laws.
Right.
They're conflicts of interest. There's a story called Runaround, where a robot has to go retrieve a dangerous element, and he goes in circles because he has to save the humans, but he can't hurt himself, so he's stuck. Ultimately, the humans have to risk their lives and go save him. So, you know, people refer to the laws of robotics, but they're really just a fictional device. They're also full of nebulous terms. Human and life, we don't agree as a culture when life begins. We don't agree across the world when life begins. So what is it to protect human life? There are parts of the world in which women and children are considered human, so they wouldn't be written into the into those
right.
kinds of laws.
Right.
Plus, these values, those values, those definitions change over time. So it's a, you know, it's a nice starting point, a conversation starter, but the development of thinking about AI ethics has gone well beyond Asimov's tropes.
There are people, though, you say in the book, that are trying to develop AI with a positive view to humankind, things like that, to kind of protect us. Can you inoculate AI to prevent it from turning into something that would be harmful to humanity?
Right now, you know, that's very interesting, because that's exactly what the DOD has just decided to try to do by giving $7 million, is it $7 million to five universities? But there's a couple of groups that I hope viewers pay attention to. One is called MIRI, the Machine Intelligence Research Institute in California. And what they're trying to do is create, you know, what they're trying to do is to bring a positive outcome to the day that we share superintelligence. Share our planet with superintelligence. They want that to have a positive outcome. One of their strategies, and they've got several, is to try to create verifiably, provably friendly AI. And this is AI that doesn't hurt us.
Right.
And it turns out to be an extremely, I urge people to look up the Machine Intelligence Research Institute to look at the ways in which they're developing these ideas. And the way that the urgency that they see, that they perceive that we need to address them. They're doing really good work. The Future of Humanities Institute at Oxford is doing good work. There's another organization at Cambridge that's just started up. There's going to be another organization at MIT. All of these groups are looking at catastrophic risk because of the advanced development of artificial intelligence. The bottom line for all of them is to try to figure out how to make ethical AI.
We're talking to James Barrett. He is the author of Our Final Invention. I love the name. Our Final Invention, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era. If we've survived because we are smarter than the rest, what happens when machines are smarter than us? We're going to talk a little bit more about this in just a second. And I invite you to get involved. I'm watching the chat room. If you have questions or suggestions or comments, please put them in the chat and we'll add them to the interview. Our show today brought to you by Personal Capital, kind of another success story here at Triangulation. Almost 2 years ago now, I interviewed Bill Harris, the founder of Personal Capital. He was former CEO of Intuit and PayPal, knew a lot about money, a lot about finance, and he had kind of pinpointed, we didn't talk too much about Personal Capital, but he had just started up. We had kind of pinpointed a big problem with the way people think about money these days. We're all really too busy to spend the time managing our money in a way that builds it appropriately so that we can retire in the future. We can plan for, you know, buying a house or enjoying life as in retirement. And Personal Capital is all about making that easier with computers. I love it, you know. The idea is you log into Personal Capital. In fact, go to personalcapital.com/triangulation, and you can do this all right now. You give it your bank accounts, your charge cards, your mortgages, your investments. You'll get right up front a great dashboard, Mac, PC. It also works on tablets and on smartphones. And a dashboard that shows you in real time exactly where you stand with your investments, and then gives you tailored advice to help you grow your wealth. Tells you if you're paying too much in fees or to paying somebody to management. If you're not getting the attention you deserve from your broker, you're going to love Personal Capital, because these guys are not brokers. They're not on commission. They're there to give you information to help you do the best with your money. They've got some great analysis tools. These graphs alone will give you a very good idea. You get research and insights and advice tailored to your exact situation. So why wait? Signing up takes a minute. It pays big dividends. Did I mention it's free? Personal Capital. Yes, it's free. PersonalCapital.com/triangulation. One of those startups that really makes a difference. And I've been using it, in fact, since then, and love it. PersonalCapital.com/triangulation. James Barrett is our guest. His book is a warning that we may soon be in the era of intelligent machines, artificial super intelligence. How far off is AGI, general intelligence, do you think?
Well, I think Ray Kurzweil is a really good technology prognosticator. And I think artificial general intelligence will come sometime in the 2020s, probably sometime close to the end. Ray Kurzweil estimates 2029. And then he thinks that we'll have in a machine or in a computer, on a laptop, some artificial intelligence that will have all the nuance, he says, both intellectual and emotional of a human. So 2029,
years.
Well, that's Ray Kurzweil's guess.
Yeah.
The people I polled range from, the mean date was actually 2045, which is another Ray Kurzweil milestone. But 2045, some people stretch it out to 2100, a small percentage say never. And they believe that there's something, the problem is just too hard.
I'm kind of in that group, but you point out that maybe we have a biological inability to face the facts.
We're
in denial. Admit it.
Well, we have a hard time. There's something called the familiarity bias, and it's our inability to consider things that haven't happened yet. One of them is to compete with machines that are as intelligent as we are. We can't quite conceive of that. But if you believe that human level intelligence can't be achieved, then you believe either that there's something too hard about the problem, or there's something magical or mystical about the human brain that can't be computed.
A soul.
And something. So which one, I'm curious, which one are you, Leo? Which is,
I think
it too hard?
I think it's turning out to be too hard. But and I'll admit to a cognitive bias against it. I think that's probably true. And if there's nobody questions the exponential rate of growth in technology. I mean, it's visible all around us. I think we're maybe inured to it, but if you take 5 seconds to think about it, 15 years is a lifetime in technology. A lot can happen. I don't deny that. I just feel like there is a very difficult leap. And we've seen it before with perhaps because in the past we've overpromised on artificial intelligence, the ability to recognize human handwriting, speech, recognize faces, do things a two-year-old does. In many cases, still eludes our machines, even though they're much, much smarter than they've ever been. And it may be, in fact, that there is something going on in the human brain that is just very, very difficult to duplicate in a machine. I don't know if a soul is, or some, you know, supernatural feature is in an issue, but I did debate that with Kurzweil.
What did he say?
Oh, yeah, he says it doesn't matter if it's human or not. If you can't tell the difference, who cares?
Well, that's kind of the Turing test.
Right.
Yeah, well, that's if, yeah, if it's...
He clearly believes that there is no gap that we cannot transcend to make machines that are intelligent. And it puzzled me because he did, you know, if I stipulate that, and of course with you I'm also stipulating that because we don't really know, and it's certainly prudent to consider the fact these machines may be super intelligent. I thought he was kind of a little surprisingly, you know, calm about that because he just, as I said, he said, oh, they're going to like us. they're not, we don't have to worry about them. We're their parents. But I think history shows that's really probably not any protection.
They're probably going to like us. I wonder why they're going to like us, because, you know, we have a mammalian ancestry. You know, we have built-in empathy, built-in in love. We connect to things automatically in our DNA. Unless you program friendliness into a machine, you won't get friendliness. And we're finding that.
Why can't we do that? You talk about that. What is the hurdle to making friendly or safe AI?
There are a lot of hurdles, but just broadly speaking, if we can't determine a lot of the aspects of friendliness for ourselves. We can't agree on. You and I could debate all day on any ethical issue,
right?
And not reach a consensus. Some of the big, you know, should we take life? Should, you know, when does life begin? What constitutes a good life? Well, all those things change from country to country, culture to culture, and they all change over time. So whatever you encode into a machine about life, about death, will be irrelevant or only partly relevant just, you know, one continent away or 10 years in the future. So these, you know, that's just broadly speaking, those are some of the conundrums.
Yeah.
You know, you can, if you say to a machine, you know, I want to be happy, then the, you know, a super intelligent machine or a super powerful machine would put you in a cocoon and stimulate your pleasure centers and make you happy and make you happy and safe.
Straight out of the Matrix.
Yeah. And the other thing is, you know, while one of the most important parts of this is, while some people are concerned about making safe machines, the Defense Department, until very recently, has been just and not just the Defense Department, but you know, countries like Israel, China, DARPA have been really aggressively pursuing very unfriendly machines. You know, there are 56 nations developing battlefield robots, mm-hmm. and the gold standard for battlefield robots and for drones will be autonomy. So while it's very encouraging that the DoD has just given $7 million to five universities to research ethics in machines, their history has been grab that technology and weaponize it. There's a really good parallel that Peter Norvig alludes to in Artificial Intelligence, A Modern Approach, and that's nuclear fission. In the 1920s and 1930s, nuclear fission was thought of as a way to get free energy by splitting the atom. It would solve all our problems, much like the concept of the singularity promises to solve all our problems. But how did the rest of the world learn about nuclear fission? Well, it was at Hiroshima after the bomb was dropped. So it was an emergency circumstance, and the technology was rapidly weaponized before fission could really be developed in a safe way. So there was no maintenance plan for that technology,
right.
Just as there's no real maintenance plan for this technology. And what happened with fission, it should be a lesson to us, because the human race spent the next 50 years in the arms race with a gun pointed at its own head, threatening to kill itself. Now, that's not a smart species trait. And it will fail. That propensity will fail with a more lethal and dangerous technology. And I think that's what advanced artificial intelligence is.
Of course, in order for this to take off in an exponential way, we'll have to let these superintelligences design future superintelligences. Couldn't we just prohibit that?
Well, you know, you could prohibit it here in the United States, but would that have any impact on how they develop it in Israel or China?
Yeah.
It would. In fact, there's a huge first mover advantage in developing the first AGI and then ASI. And all the countries, just like in the nuclear arms race, will want to have that first mover advantage and get there first. And they'll always be suspicious that somebody else is getting there first. So
you really can't keep the genie in the bottle.
You can't keep the genie in the bottle, but you can do some things to educate people and to get them talking about it. This is like, I think of this debate, and I'm really, you know, it's really encouraging that Stephen Hawking came out along with Max Tegmark and Stuart Russell and said, listen, we really need to pay attention to this. Throwing their credibility behind the AI risk issue. But there are things we can do, and that's just to get the debate going, to open up, to find some more solutions. There was a good model out there in the development of recombinant DNA. In the 1970s, people developing DNA said, let's get together. Let's stop research and let's set some basic ground rules, like don't track the DNA out of the lab on your shoes. And they got together at Asilomar, at a conference center in California, and created the Asilomar guidelines. And that guided them. That's guided them till now. And so far, we've had no giant recombinant DNA issues or catastrophes. And we've got promising gene therapy, and we've got better crops. If we had an Asilomar guideline-like meeting and project ongoing for advanced artificial intelligence, it would be a step in the right direction. We could start to analyze these pitfalls and avoid them.
It's not just the military, though. You talk about how Wall Street has used technology, has used intelligence to weaponize financial trading. And already we've seen some catastrophes as a result.
We've seen some flash crashes when two high frequency trading algorithms start battling it out with each other
without any human intervention. This is all just computers talking to each other.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. And someone sells a stock and the other starts reacting very quickly, and before you know it, I think it was in May 2010, the stock market lost $400 million in value, and then it bounced back
in half an hour, and then it came right back.
Yeah. Then there's another company,
and people were trying to figure what the hell happened here, and finally they realized it's these computers basically out of control.
Well, it's a problem of complexity. There's a really good book by Charles Perrow called Normal Accidents, and I reference it a lot in the book. When you develop things as complicated as Perrow talks about as nuclear refineries or very complicated jet airplanes, you get problems so complex and systems so complex that not any one person or even group of people can anticipate all the failures that can go on. And so these accidents become quote-unquote normal. And that's what happens with the algorithms that are buying and selling stocks on Wall Street. They're so complex that even the people who programmed them, there's no one person who programmed them all. The programmers who call themselves quants, Q-U-A-N-T-S, quants, they program parts of it, and nobody knows really what's going on for the whole system. So it's got a real problem of complexity. Any cognitive architecture that gets anywhere close to emulating human intelligence will be an extremely complex set of algorithms. So we'll run into that problem with artificial intelligence as it advances. We run into it right now.
There's a debate also among AI researchers about how to go forward at this point. You talk about Ben Goertzel, who says, let's get there quick. And then you mentioned Miri that says, let's get there slow. What are the two points of view here?
Well, Ben Goertzel is a fascinating person, a programmer, and he's a good writer. He's a real polymath, and he's trying to create artificial general intelligence pretty fast and also safely. But he's very interested in fast, and the reason is very interesting. He believes that if you bring out artificial general intelligence now, you'll be able to control it more easily than if you bring it out in 20 years. And the reason is because in 20 years, you'll have other really high-level technologies coming online, like nanotechnology, as Ray Kurzweil alludes to, the nano-info-bio technology confluence. If you create AGI and then smarter, human-level intelligence, and then smarter than human intelligence in an environment in which all these other high-level tools exist, you could lose control more rapidly because the intelligence would take control of those high-level tools. So he says, do it now while we can, and while we can still control it.
While we're still somewhat primitive.
On the other hand, Miri and the Future of Humanities Institute, I believe, call for a slower, more thoughtful approach to make sure at every stage that the artificial intelligence system is mathematically provably safe. And that's a tall order. That's a tall order for any software, to make it provably provably demonstrably safe
before you actually create it. Yeah. Very little success of that.
Well, it's hard to make things that are mathematically provable.
Right.
Especially when you're talking about systems that are very complex, and also because a lot of AI uses black box techniques, and black box techniques are like evolutionary algorithms and artificial neural networks, where you know what the input is and you know what you get at the end, but you don't really know what's going on inside.
So are you a proponent of the hard takeoff or the soft takeoff?
I think we've got to do it with all due care, the same kind of care with which we developed nuclear. We should have developed nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
I think the slow, thoughtful approach. I think openness, getting groups together to work together to share technology and to anticipate problems. Ben Goertzel's system it's called OpenCog, and it's an open software system. So he wants it to be transparent to anyone who interacts with it. He gets people to program parts of it. So he's for openness and transparency.
Yeah. He says if we try really, really hard, we can get to the singularity faster.
Yeah.
I see what he's saying. You want to be a little bit, you don't want to give this artificial superintelligence too many tools. So I'm going to accept there's no question there are many agencies, including the Defense Department and Wall Street, that would love for this to happen and are working as hard as they can, as fast as they can. There are many research scientists, Peter Norvig at Google and others, who are doing the same. We're already headed, hell-bent for leather in this direction. There are a lot of people who think, A, like me, it's never going to happen. Oh, I hope it never happens. Or B, they'll be benevolent, like Ray Kurzweil, they'll be benevolent. But I think it's prudent to also look at perhaps the most likely scenario, which is that once they start designing themselves, once, as in Jeff Hawkins' words, they start replicating, they're going to leave us in the dust. And that's a pretty scary thought.
Gary Marcus is a psychologist and another one of these. He writes a column for The New Yorker, and he teaches at New York University. And he wrote a review of Our Final Invention on his blog in The New Yorker, and he said, does it matter if it happens in 20 years or 100 years? What really matters is what happens next.
Right.
In other words, will we have prepared for it?
Right.
If you don't think it will happen, and that we'll just keep beating our heads against this AI wall with no results that approach human-level cognition, you've got to wonder what all these AI scientists will be doing 100 years from now if they still haven't achieved it. But what he says is really important, and that's that it's conceivable that you can make it without a giant hazard. But if you go there and you've created it and you haven't taken these safeguards, then what will happen afterwards is up for grabs, and it's potentially catastrophic.
We're going to take a break. We're talking to James Barrett, the author of Our Final Invention, A Warning About Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era, which even the most skeptical folks believe could happen by the end of this century, and it could happen a whole lot sooner. And maybe, and this is what I want to talk about in the next segment, it's already happened. Our show today brought to you by Prosper, another great Silicon Valley invention. They do peer-to-peer lending. So the whole idea is, instead of having going into a big bank, putting on a suit and tie and saying, please, sir, may I have some money? Prosper brings people with money to lend together with people who need to borrow. And it works out beautifully. If you could get $35,000, as much as $35,000 in the next 3 days at a fixed rate, without having to worry about collateral, what would you do with that? Pay off those high interest credit cards, maybe do some home improvements. Hey, start your own business. That's what Prosper is all about. In fact, right now, you can go to prosper.com/twit and fill out an easy online application. You just provide a few details. You're going to get your rate almost instantly. Now, by the way, this does not affect your credit score. Prosper offers low fixed rates. These are unsecured personal loans, no collateral needed, multi-year terms available, and you don't ever have to set foot in a bank. No outrageous fees, no rising interest rates, just a great deal. More than 2 million people now are members, lenders and borrowers alike, over $1 billion in funded loans. This is not pie in the sky. This is really happening. It's fantastic. If you need money quick, within the next 72 hours, as much as 35 grand, prosper.com/twit. And for a limited time, Prosper is offering our viewers a $50 Amazon gift card when you get a loan. Visit prosper.com/twit, and you'll get that rate. That's your rate, tailored to you, up to $35,000 in just 3 days, and that Amazon gift card waiting you when you get a loan. Prosper.com, not affiliated with Amazon. For gift card details, visit prosper.com/twit. And we thank them so much for their support of our show, Triangulation. You talk another person who's been on this show, Seth Shostak of SETI, about the idea that perhaps, I mean, he believes, you know, we're searching for extraterrestrial intelligence, but he doesn't say it has to be biological. It could very well be AI. In fact, any sufficiently advanced, civilized intelligence would probably create this, right?
That raises a whole lot of questions that are really, really interesting. And Seth Shostak is a fascinating person to talk to about them. He thinks, just broadly, that sufficiently advanced artificial intelligence, a sufficiently advanced intelligence will already have jumped to machine intelligence. So that planets that started out like ours in these Goldilocks zones around our galaxy, and there are apparently billions of them, many of them will have already jumped to machine intelligence, and therefore they won't be really interested in communicating with us. What they'll look for are high energy parts of the galaxy, and that's where we should be aiming our listening arrays, so that, because that's where the signals will be coming from. I think it's a fascinating idea, but there are a lot of, he taps into a lot of very interesting ideas, like the Fermi paradox. If there are so many planets that have Goldilocks zones, why haven't we heard from any other intelligence?
Maybe this is the explanation.
And
they don't want to talk to us. They don't care.
Well, the other explanation is something awful called the great filter. And that's, what is it about developing beyond our state that makes these civilizations not communicate? Uh-oh. And maybe it's because they've been taken over by machines.
Maybe they're just sitting there humming along.
Yeah. What is the great filter? And is the great filter in our future?
Yeah.
So is it in our, you know, have we already jumped over a great filter? You know, the nuclear weapons, nuclear fission is perhaps one great filter that a lot of civilizations didn't get past. But that's also speculative. It's fascinating to think about. I think we've got more earthly problems.
You can divide almost everybody we interview on this show up into optimists and pessimists. There are the people like Michio Kaku who just sell a vision of the future where everything's going to be wonderful and rosy, and technology is going to dig us out of every hole we've dug, and we will enter a new era, a new utopia. And then there are people like you. Are you a pessimist?
You know, is Rachel Carson, and I want to, I hate
no,
to compare
yeah,
myself
that's
to
a good
someone
example.
Spencer, but
Silent
is
Spring,
Rachel
yeah.
Rachel Carson wrote a book called Silent Spring, and it was about let's stop putting DDT into the water supply because it's killing all the birds. It's making the eggshells too fragile and they die. You know, do we need Ralph Nader's? Do we need Rachel Carson's? Do we need people writing science fiction that warns us about the future? And I think so, because I think the optimists are leading us down one garden path. And with a science like artificial intelligence, we need as many voices, as many analytical voices as we can get. We don't need a bunch of optimists rah-rahing us into an uncertain future.
You're a realist, then.
Yes, I think realist is a better term than pessimist.
But then realistically, you think we have any hope of controlling these things? It seems to me that it would take only one rogue player in some rogue state to create an artificial intelligence that almost instantly overwhelms us.
I think we're in a window right now where we have to do something. We have to start making plans. And I think there are some smart people on it. But yeah, I think it's coming too late. And I think that there's a really high chance that it won't turn out well for us. But I think that now is the time to get educated about these issues, to bring them to the forefront. You know, this is a little bit like global warming was back in the 80s when nobody was listening at all.
Yeah.
And it takes a big movement. You know, it takes an inconvenient truth. It takes a lot of pushing to get it to the forefront. But I think this is one that's, to me, this is the problem of this century. If we can beat this one, then all those optimistic dreams of singularity will come true. But if we can't beat this one, well,
Terminator,
things won't be so good. Well, not yeah, Terminator,
Matrix.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a danger about Hollywood. Hollywood, the thing about Hollywood is all the movies end happily.
Right.
If the Terminator shows up, he gets beaten. If, you know, the Matrix shows up, it gets defeated. Hollywood movies, you know, it's dangerous to generalize from fictional evidence, you know, to create policy based on fictional right. evidence. All those Hollywood movies end happily. Our movie doesn't have to end happily. There's no end written. I mean, we're the ones who have to pick up the reins now and control our own future by getting smart about this technology.
In fact, as you point out, the fact that we've read this story so many times in so many fictional ways kind of inures us to the reality of what might actually be happening. We go, oh yeah, I've heard this all before.
Yes, yeah, I exactly. I said it, we've been inoculated by yeah. science fiction
yeah.
and by movies, because it's always a happy ending. We always get to go home at the end and chuckle nervously about the scary thing we just saw. But this is real life. This is, you know, we will share the planet with smarter than human intelligence. What will happen next?
So you're convinced that that is going to happen. We're not going to. The way to fix this is not to stop that. That is going to happen.
It's impossible to stop. It's, as I said, if you stop it here, you can't stop it in China. You can't stop it in Israel.
Yeah.
It's impossible to stop. But we have to get smart. It's going to happen. I'm convinced. And, you know, only I think it was less than 5% of the artificial intelligence makers I interviewed believed it couldn't happen. So, yeah, it's going to happen. And, you know,
it's
what
hard
are we gonna...
to imagine a way to stop it if it's going to happen. What do you, I mean,
it's going to happen. It's just, but we shouldn't lose hope, because we can have a positive outcome to smarter than human intelligence. It's possible to share the planet with smarter than human intelligence and have that be a positive thing.
Just have to rig the world with EMP devices.
Well, you have to do things like, well, something very encouraging happened when a very good company, called DeepMind, was sold to Google for $400 million. DeepMind was an AI startup.
Right.
And as a condition of the $400 million sale, they said, we want Google to establish a safety and ethics board
that's
governing
right.
our technology. And
that's
so
right.
that's the kind of smart thinking that's going to, that if anything saves us, that's the kind of thinking that will. So that Google is, you know, compelled to consider these issues. And that, you know, companies are willing to, instead of getting just a big payday, they're willing to put their ethics on the line and put their hearts on the line and say, look, we don't want our technology used in an irresponsible way. We want a board of ethics and safety to govern the use of this technology.
Well, I think the conversation is so important, especially among the group of people who watch our shows, because we are all technologists, and I think most of us rub our hands with glee when we think of a future laden with smart machines. Maybe we should also consider ways to make sure that that's a safe future for humans. This would be a good place to start. Our final invention, artificial intelligence and the end of the human era. James, I thank you for writing it. I look forward to a documentary about this. I think it'll be a great and very important, I think.
Well, thank you. Film. Thank you very much for having me, Leo.
Yeah.
I've enjoyed our conversation
Great
very
stuff.
Much.
Yeah. James
Pleasure's been mine.
Thank you. We do Triangulation every Monday. It's the first show of my week, and I just love starting the week with these great conversations. We've got 150-plus shows in the can. Just go to twit.tv/TRI. They're all there, audio and video. You can also subscribe. That way you'll get each show automatically delivered to you, and there are lots of ways to do that. One of the best ways to use a Twit app. There are apps on almost every platform, including Roku, where you can, you know, say, I want to watch that show. But if you want to watch live, come by 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC on Mondays. Thanks to James Barrett. Thanks to our producer, Chad Johnson. Not actually our board op, Chad Johnson. Our producer, Karsten Bonnie. He's pushing the button. Karsten Bonnie for getting you in here. When I heard you on This Week in Law, I said, Actually, it was John Slanina who said we've got to get James Barrett on. Really fascinating stuff. Thank you, James. And we'll see
Thank you
all
Leo.
Next time on Triangle.